Uncover the biggest questions in multiple sclerosis and join the conversation that's shaping the future for patients and clinicians. It's time to unmute MS.
Unmute MS was created and funded by Novartis Pharmaceuticals UK and is intended for UK healthcare professionals.
Welcome back, everyone. I am very glad to say that Mark Webb is still our esteemed guest. He's an MS advocate and a patient himself. Now, from working with Mickey Mouse to living life as a young chap, living unaware pretty much that his single symptoms cropping up from time to time were in fact MS, Mark's MS story is one infused with humour and a real openness. His goal is to help the MS community, including clinicians, to understand the condition from the patient's perspective.
My very first symptom was 3 days of intense pins and needles right down my left-hand side. But being a 24-year-old older male, I totally ignored it when it went away. I became fatigued earlier, the bladder was worse, everything was saying to me, yeah, something is up. We booked a GP booking and he told me just straight out, you've got MS, good luck, old chap. I think there's some fantastic neurologists out there, but there's one or two who do clash with people and maybe see us as statistics on a piece of paper.
So let's jump straight in, Mark, to the point in your story where perhaps things start to change. And I'm wondering, is it almost as simple as waiting for things to happen? Or are there bits in between your appointments with your care team where it feels like a kind of slide into a different stage? And what did that feel like from your perspective? Now, I ask that question because Dr. Abhijit Chowdhury, who was also one of our guests on Unmute MS, and he advocates very strongly for early and efficacious treatment in the UK. He had a question for you, and it was very much on this subject. He wanted to know how you noticed the transition towards SPMS, if you did notice it.
Yes. There's relapses and flare-ups, aren't there, that people talk about. Mine, even though it definitely was relapsing remitting, you know, and I'm sure we're going to go on to discuss the fact that I'm now progressive. But I never had those. Some people can literally wake up and think, oh, bugger, I'm in a relapse. I'll call my doctor. I'll get on steroids. I'm going to be in a mess for a week or a month now. I've never had that. So mine's been a bit of a slide, like you said. And it's one of those things that things like Facebook reminders suddenly tell you, oops, gosh, 2 years ago I was doing X and now I can't do X. Or if you went on a similar walk that you used to be able to do and now you're too tired or you have to pop behind a bush for a wee or whatever that you didn't have to before. So there were kind of constant mini shocks for me as to, oh no, I am worse, aren't I? That I'd never realised. Whereas there are a lot of people who, as I said, can pinpoint a relapse, can pinpoint the day that they could no longer see properly out of their left eye or whatever. That's never happened to me. I've slid downhill without ever having to make that emergency call to an MS nurse or a cry to help to a counsellor or for mental health issues. Or I've just staggered downhill or rolled downhill on my journey.
In terms of what led ultimately to the diagnosis of SPMS, and I think you said that was in 2019, what happened in the lead up to that moment?
Nothing very specific. I had moved to the South Coast. I currently live in Bedfordshire on the Dunstable Downs, so close to Whipsnade Zoo, if you can picture it, that I can hear the lions on a good day, which is very cool for Bedfordshire. But yes, we'd moved to the South Coast, partly because who wouldn't like to move to the South Coast, but partly because my wife's parents live there and she felt the need for her support for her. Because, of course, you know, and she puts it very well. She talks about, You know, we've all got your MS. And, you know, I often think that actually she's got the MS worse than me in a sense, because I kind of just deal with catheters and pain and whatever else I have to get on with. And she has to witness this and see me falling apart and take on more and more duties. But yes, so we'd moved to the South Coast, and it really, I think, was a fresh look from a neurologist down there. Bournemouth Hospital, was it? Or Southampton, by the by. But they were very good. They gave me a whole overview, lots of new MRIs. And rather than being that routine once a year thing, it was like a fresh look. And I think it was the fresh look that prompted them to say, you're probably secondary progressive MS. And of course, I think anybody listening to this who knows anything about MS knows that there's not one day that you suddenly become secondary progressive. It's most definitely a grey area. So at some point, we agreed I had secondary progressive. So I don't think there was a trigger moment. It might just have been the fact that we had moved to a different neurologist who had taken a fresh look. And in terms of the outcome of that, the decision was to end my term of the current treatment I was on. And secondary progressive, you do start to feel slightly on the shelf because there's very few treatments out there for you, and you're encouraged to exercise, to look after yourself, to think about your work future, etc. So you're slightly, I felt slightly parked aside, but not in any disdainful way, just because they know that at that point they can't do an awful lot for you at the moment.
In terms of your working life over that period, I know that we've kind of seesawed back and forward, Mark, but you obviously had social media available to work on in your previous role. How long did that last for, and what were those moments like in your working life? How did that change as your physical health changed?
Yes, so more and more while I was working for Dixon's, I was working more and more from home. I felt even in my social media capacity, I feared I was going to let the company down at some point. And I was so loyal to them that before I did that, and this was after an 11-year tenure where fatigue was really kicking in. I was a wheelchair user, out and about with a walker at home, but fatigue and cognitive dysfunction to a certain extent were really starting to kick in. And I went, this is my third point about how wonderful they were with me. I went to them and said, look, I'm not going to cope. Can I leave now, please? I don't think I put it that way. But, you know, I was on 3 months notice or 6 months notice. And without any negotiation, they gave me an awful lot more to look after me. And so the upshot of that was that I wrote a bit of a eulogy on LinkedIn, which is another social media platform. And I can remember exactly what I said at the end of that eulogy. And I summed up those 3 points, the allyship at the beginning, the creativity with giving me a role that would help me benefit the company and myself, and then the departure. And it finished, be like Dixon's Carphone, because it had merged with Carphone Warehouse by then. And that went viral. And I had 875,000 views and led to phone calls and job opportunities and chats. And that included a chat with George Pepper, who is the gentleman who founded Shift.ms and has MS himself. And he offered me a part-time role as head of PR, head of communications. So really, because of this company previously having treated me so well, I found a part-time role with a charity that I already adored. And in addition, I proudly and happily call myself a social media floozy. I started to be a support to other people with MS that I could. I started to advocate for, as I said, MS and then disability and then diversity. And this has led me to becoming a public speaker.
So Mark, since being diagnosed with SPMS, what has the kind of care landscape looked like for you? I know you're very much part of Shift MS and very involved in the community, so there's that support. But I'm thinking in terms of the clinical support. What does it look like for you now?
So secondary progressive, as I said, you slightly feel on the shelf, but there are some treatments coming along. So I'm on a trial, so that gives me a little bit of extra monitoring. But at the point when that decision, even though, as I said, it wasn't a day that suddenly I switched to secondary progressive, but at the point when I was confirmed as secondary progressive, a whole new system of sort of health support came in and assessments on what my home was like, occupational therapists visiting. So some people who... you know, it's not end of life care, but it's kind of it's coping care. And I found that very helpful. People who could spend a little bit more time with me. And that really set me up to, you know, I after conversations, we do okay in life still. I'm still working a little bit. And earning some decent money as a public speaker. My wife is brilliant and earns some money, so we don't qualify for lots of freebies, but I did invest as a result of the occupational therapy chats in one of those hospital beds, you know, so I can raise up there. I've got bits and bobs to grab onto in the loo and the shower. I've got a seated shower. Now and at some point soon we'll get a fully accessible bathroom for me. But it was kind of an all-round cuddle I got, a medical cuddle, I'll call it, in terms of just helping me cope with this next phase where we know I'm not going to be cured. We know there's not going to be a massive turnaround. But I did feel very supported in national health terms, and I think I've got great neurologists now. They will give me 15 minutes of their time. They are human with me. I'm very grateful, but I know there's not a lot they can do with me. But occupational therapy wise, for example, it's great. And of course, again, if we refer back to the pandemic, lots of companies turned on a dime to suddenly deliver home working, and that was great, and it helps me campaign for oi, let disabled people work. But actually the health service has also been great in terms of, you know, they struggled for a little while in you know, everybody was diverted to looking after the C word, and totally understandably so. For a while we were a little bit bereft, but after a while the system of home chats over the phone, over the screen with my neurologist or an MS nurse, I think has been dealt with superbly. We all had a tough few months in MS terms. Well, in anybody vulnerable terms, the government had the habit of releasing these statistics that said X hundred people died today, but put in brackets, don't worry, because 93% of those were vulnerable. Well, if you're vulnerable, that really doesn't feel a great stat to read. So I think a lot of people with MS had a really tough time. And sorry, not just MS, but anybody clinically vulnerable. And of course, neurologists and other gurus were scrabbling to understand the impact of COVID on people with compromised immune systems, people with advanced MS, what would be the impact of the vaccine depending on what treatments you were on, etc., etc. So everybody was scrabbling for information. It wasn't just people with MS, and it wasn't just Shift MS or the MS Society trying to help and find out. everybody was trying to understand the Brave New World. But I think, you know, after that Scrabble, when, oh my word, it was grim for everybody, I think the systems turned out really well.
There's one symptom that I wanted to talk to you about, Mark. I think you call it cog fog.
Yes.
So the brain fog, I'm guessing this is referring to. I know that one of our other clinicians who we've talked to on Unmute MS, Dr. Nikos Savangelou, has talked about the impact of cognitive changes on patients. And for him, very much this needs to be vitally understood. The tests need to be better. And I just wonder what it's been like for you. When did cog fog become a thing?
Gradually as well. I can't pinpoint that really. I would probably say as I came towards the end of my tenure at Dixon's, which would have meant that I was still officially relapsing remitting. Could I have been secondary progressive by then? Maybe. So that would have been sort of 2015, 16, 17, I don't know. But I was struggling to cope with a full time, well, I was doing a 4-day week. And I really couldn't put in the hours effectively, I felt. I'm now at the stage where I will have to have a lie down after talking to you, because I've put sort of an hour, not because of talking to you, Julie, you haven't caused it. But yes, after any public speaking engagement, any focus of my mind, any writing of a text, my brain needs to back off. So I'm very aware that perhaps I have 3 or 4 good hours of functioning a day. And I want to spend some of that time with my children, exchanging pleasantries with my beautiful wife, etc. So that's very hard. One of the other, it hurts really, is how often my children joke or remind me that I've already said that before. Now, they're fine with it, so they're not critical of me, but golly, it's tough being so forgetful that I'm really not sure if I've said something before. It's tough being reminded that I've said something before. It's tough keeping up to date with my life. So I send my tactic is to send myself a to-do list every day, which is updated. And I'm afraid I'm always over ambitious with what I want to achieve every day. So there's lots of rollovers into the next day or the next week. But that's my way of coping, because I know I can't remember diddly squat, really. The other aspect cog fog, cognitive dysfunction, and we can insert a bloke joke here, is just not being able to multitask. I need to be in a quieter room. I can't cope at a dinner party because I can't focus on one conversation. I can't deliver 2 or 3 different projects in a day. I just can't anymore.
What do you think families need, Mark? I know you said before that your wife says if there's somebody in the house that has MS, everybody does. And I can very much understand that perspective and where it comes from. But is there something missing in the already overstretched system for families? Is there more that needs to be done? Or is this something that Shift MS, that other organisations already do really well?
Yes, it exists in the health service and in the charity world. They do exist. My fantastic wife, I'm never going to stop saying it, my fantastic wife hasn't opted for that, and I wish she would. And I think there's an awful lot of, because of course they become carers to some extent or not. You know, I can't make myself a cup of tea, or if I make myself a cup of tea, I've got to sit there and drink it because I can't carry it anywhere with my wheelchair. So I'm dependent even for a coffee, and that's so tough on those around you. And I think that for the support network is there. I'm not sure if it's used enough, or are health services publicising themselves enough to the non-MSer, to the person impacted by MS. I think more than, I think my wife is impacted more by MS than me, as I've said. But the support is all for me.
Mark, thinking now about the conversations that you'll continue to have with your clinicians and the multidisciplinary team, where you have to advocate for yourself, I'm wondering, how do you develop a voice where you can advocate for yourself? How does that happen as a patient?
Yes. So there's a couple of things. So CogFoc impacts my voice, so to speak. So I can go into a hospital with a list of things in my mind that I want to chat with the neurologist or the MS nurse or the physio or whatever. And they're out of my mind by the time I've sat down in the chair. In terms of actually what I'd like to hear from the clinicians at this point, just plays into the blooming annoying side of MS is we just don't know. So I would love more clarity. I'm not sure if they can give that to me because I can be a statistic. They could probably tell me what my life expectancy is from now, but only statistically. So I'm afraid anxiety is going to continue to play. I'd love some hard, honest conversations. But at the same time, I might luck out and live and stay relatively mobile for so much longer. So is that useful? I don't know. And that's probably not a very helpful answer, Julie. But that's the uncertainty of MS, and I get that.
That's an interesting thought, because I've always thought about how difficult it is in any person's lifetime to go into a room with a consultant, any kind of clinician. And sometimes it can feel that there's a bit of a power imbalance there, because there's that, you know, they know, but I don't know. So how can we encourage people to build kind of a voice to advocate, to say, just give it to me straight. I'm the kind of person who likes to hear things like this. Or actually, I would prefer that you said it to me like this. Can we help people to encourage, to be able to build that kind of confidence, the self-voice, if you think? Is that even a thing?
Yes. I would put all the weight on a clinician to be more forthright to someone. Well, not more forthright in saying, right, you've got 3 minutes until your left leg falls off. I don't mean like that. I would encourage clinicians to come forward and say, look, what do you want to know about? What are you worried about? And really push it. It's just like going beyond, are you okay? And then somebody says yes. You have to say, yeah, but are you really okay? I would encourage any health professional to push harder, because there's people like myself who are thoroughly engaged with every aspect of our MS advancement. I don't have the CogFog to follow some of the data, and I don't follow the scientific papers, but I know lots of MSers in my world who do. But we will surely be the minority. Most of people with MS are feeling sorry for themselves, in the dark, googling a little bit of exercise, a little bit of interaction with charities, but feeling scared and timid. I think that responsibility should lie firmly with the clinician, because it's the MSs who aren't engaged, and they're going to be the majority who really need pushing. Just to interrupt, I've just gone for a wee there. I've got a suprapubic catheter now. You may want to ask me about that later, but I've just gone for a wee while I've been talking to you.
Mark, what's that like, if you don't mind sharing?
Sorry, just swallowing some water because I drink an awful lot of water now. So My three-stage journey of my urine story. Let's talk wee. So I was wetting myself and visiting gateposts for years, as discussed. Then the intermittent self-catheterizing. So that's shoving something inside you 3 or 4 times a day to fully empty your bladder. And every time you're doing that, you are introducing a foreign body into yourself. And however good you are at following all the cleanliness and the rituals that you should do, as I was, some of you can be susceptible to UTIs, bladder infections, urinary tract infections. And mine hit me particularly badly when I had them, and I had them frequently. So I was usually blue lighted to hospital with all the paramedics whispering sepsis, sepsis, sepsis to each other. As soon as I was in, I would be on morphine because my spasms would be turning into paralysis. But I'm afraid UTIs were far too frequent, even though I think I was being a good boy. And I was also wearing pads. So I was not having a great time with it. And at some point I had the conversation. Can't even remember how it came up. Suddenly we decided, let's go for a suprapubic catheter. That is a day operation. In-out operation. It happened during the height of COVID, so that was really tough for me because I'd been isolating. So from having, I live in the lovely, I'm looking out over fields right now. I was quite happily working from home, exercising on the patio, watching Netflix, lifting weights. Hadn't really seen a mask except for Amazon delivery men. And suddenly I was in a hospital surrounded by masks, knowing that somebody was going to chop into my bladder. So that was a tough time. The procedure is relatively simple. It's a cut below your tummy button, direct into your bladder, and a tube is inserted. And you have forever got either a tap or a bag coming out of your tummy. I've opted to keep the bag. And the upshot is that I am now a water addict. I drink so much water. Because one of the automatic things with bladder infections and, sorry, with catheters and with wetting yourself is there's an almost automatic... and you shouldn't do it, is you stop drinking enough water and that leads to more bladder infections. So from drinking, being told by every continence advisor to drink 2 litres and probably managing 1 litre a day, I now drink 3 to 4 litres a day. And that leads me to actually having to take a couple of vitamin supplements because I flush through so much, you know, things like potassium, people tell me. So I'm afraid I love it. It's not very sexy having a dangly bag. It's a bit weird that I've just weed while talking to you. But I'm afraid health-wise, it was a horrible step to take. But it's absolutely brilliant. And touch wood, I'm 15 months in and I haven't been to hospital once with a bladder infection.
That's fantastic. Mark, I wanted to be able to ask you as we start to bring things to a close, what has being able to share your humour meant for you, for your family, for the community? What's it felt like to be able to find joy and laughter in all of this?
I like to laugh, and that helps me talk about uncomfortable things while informing people. So it's a dual thing. It's my defence mechanism. Laughing rather than fighting, and I slip in engaging, interesting text or speech. I can slip in real messages in between my bad jokes. So I think I keep people informed, and I keep myself upbeat. So I think it works both ways.
I'm wondering if there's another question you would like MS doctors and MS nurses to know about the patient experience with MS. We call it, what would you like to unmute with MS and why? And I wonder what that question might be so that we can pass it along the chain in our episodes.
Yes, you warned me you would ask me this. And I've had about six different answers. And I'm still struggling. I think not enough attention is paid to the mental health side and the mental struggle side. And by that, I mean cog fog. There's not an awful lot of treatments out there for it, as I understand. I just need to sleep more, drink less, probably. That might help. but I would like those aspects of what can be a very functional conversation discussed. And there's going to be no easy solution. But unmuted for me would be to talk to me about my future with... I know that there was a neurologist called it something similar to, and I'm not going to name him because he had to retract it, but it was a little bit like having mild dementia. And I think that upset people, but I think it's true. And I think that bit could be confronted, because we can talk about walking sticks and wheelchairs and disease-modifying therapies and specific diets. But I really don't think enough is paid, attention is paid to the mental health of people with MS, the mental health of families around, families and support network around people with advancing MS. And I don't think there's enough attention paid to how our brain is literally atrophying, shrinking, struggling to deal with day-to-day processing, not just in mental health, but in thinking health, in professional health, in remembering to put the bins out, whatever. I'd love those, that area. It's not just about my legs and my bladder.
I love the phrase you used there, Mark, when you said thinking health, not just physical health, but thinking health. And it's been such a pleasure to have this conversation. Thank you for educating me. It's been a riot. I've really appreciated your candor. Thank you so much for being with us. I very, very much appreciate all of your insight.
An absolute pleasure, and lovely to meet you, Julie.
And it's an enormous thank you to you, our listeners, for joining us for this series of Unmute MS. I feel thoroughly educated and enlightened with every episode, and we hope to continue to bring you the guests, the stories, and their insights that will help us all to unmute MS. We will hope to see you for our new series, but bye for now.
This podcast was created by Novartis Pharmaceuticals UK in April 2022 with job reference code 192222.